Well, this morning I'm going to start out by telling you a little story from my own life, maybe 2 or 3 days ago, before Sesshin started. It was the morning. I was going to be working at 2:30 in the afternoon, and I decided to sneak out and get in a little bike ride, which is one of my great passions in life. I had my bike shorts on, I was all suited up, my water bottle was full, everything was set, and I decided to sneak out the back door past the little TV room at the side of the hallway, hopefully unnoticed, and get on my bike and do my ride and come back, take a shower and go to work. So I'm walking past the door and I hear this voice, "Poppy, can you come in and watch Wally with me?" This is my 10-year-old granddaughter, Alyssa. So I said, okay. She's not over all that much, and I did want to spend some time with her. So I came in, and I was somewhere after the beginning of this movie that was on the TV called Wall-E. And I think, I didn't see the title, but I think it's Wall and then a space and then an E. So I started to watch this with my lovely granddaughter. Well, where I started, Wally, who is this robot, is in a landscape, and the landscape is devastated, burned out. There were deteriorating buildings that were kind of smoking. The sky was brown, you could barely see any light coming through. And as you looked over this devastated landscape, there were no trees. There was no vegetation. There were no people. There was just this one little boxy robot with these two big camera bug eyes zipping around on little tank treads over this bumpy landscape full of garbage. And there was also one other thing that you noticed in the frame. It was a cockroach, a single cockroach. So Wally, apparently, as I'm watching this, had the expertise as a robot of being a trash compactor. So Wally would scoop up all sorts of trash that was lying in steaming piles everywhere. And when he was full of this trash, he would make this gesture as if someone was trying to have a bowel movement, like really pushing down. And then all of a sudden would pop out this perfect, you know, cube of intensely compacted trash, which then he would place on top of other cubes, making a wall. And then you started to notice that these big skyscrapers and buildings and everything was made out of these little cubes of trash. So this is some futuristic Earth, maybe the year 2270. I remember when I saw the movie 2001, I thought it would never come. And then all of a sudden we're in 2014 and 2001 seems like ancient history. So Wally's going around scooping up trash and bearing down and popping out these blocks and putting them up on walls and creating perhaps a new building, because that's what Wally is trained to do. And in scooping up trash, Wally notices something that he hasn't seen before, I presume. It was a tiny little skinny green plant with a few leaves. So Wally scoops this up and he brings it over to a little place where he has a secret stash, and he just leaves it there and goes back to compacting trash. Well, as the movie goes on, this spaceship comes down to this barren landscape of Earth. Very modernistic, very fearsome. It comes out of the sky, and Wally doesn't know what the hell it is, and it's very scary, and it's kicking up dust and making an incredible noise, and lands. And then out of this spaceship comes a beautiful, gleaming, very modern, not like Wally, this dirty, beat-up robot, but this beautiful, modern, gleaming robot, obviously from the year 2270, comes out. And as the movie goes on, you begin to get it that Wally is a man and this robot is a woman, and they develop a relationship as two robots might develop when they begin to really like each other. So eventually this beautiful, gleaming, white, really sexy robot finds this plant in scanning around. It has this laser beam, and it sort of scans and looks for things, and you can see that it scans an object, and then there's like numbers and blah, 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 and then it makes an identification and decides whether or not it's something that it's interested in. Well, when it happened upon this plant, it was very interested. So it grabbed this plant and it put it in some place in its midsection, and lights were flashing, and you saw this green plant-like glow on a set of lights at the bottom of this robot. You could tell that one of its jobs was to find life somewhere in the universe. And then it was time for this robot to go, because this giant spaceship came back down to this area of Earth, and the robot got into the spaceship, and Wally was heartbroken. He didn't know what to do. He had to be with this robot, so he grabs onto the spaceship and holds on for dear life as the spaceship zooms out of the Earth's gravity and goes through all these different places in the solar system, first through the asteroid belt, out into deep space, and then eventually comes to this other much, much larger construction, which was some kind of floating satellite way, way, way far away from this burnt out hulk of Earth that obviously humans had abandoned hundreds and hundreds of years before because it got destroyed. So Wally's hanging on to this spaceship, and the spaceship lands on this giant contraption. And then Wally finds himself in a completely different world that he's never seen before. So he gets out of the spaceship and he somehow avoids detection. He's looking for this girl robot, which he hasn't quite found yet, and he stumbles into this conveyor belt. Now he's on a conveyor belt. The conveyor belt bursts out into this super highway. It's multi-lane and jammed with these vehicles. One person to a vehicle, these are human beings. They're lying on these little vehicles, and every single human being is wearing the same kind of blue jumpsuit, and they're all morbidly obese. And they're lying on their backs on this contraption with a screen in front of their face that is feeding them constant entertainment as they zip around one next to the other on this superhighway, and each one has a big gulp, like a giant cup of a soft drink, and sipping out of the soft drink and zipping around with this screen, you know. And then constant advertising going on. They keep passing these billboards, and on the billboards is just one thing. It's a logo. It's this big B and a little N and then a big L. Well, that happened to be, as you listen to the constant drone of the advertising that's going on, as all these thousands and thousands of obese humans lying on each of their own vehicles, completely isolated from one another because they're looking at these screens of entertainment while they sip on their big gulps, is saying, you can get anything you want at B&L. B&L was buy and large, buy and large. At buy and large, you can get whatever you want. You can imagine some future Walmart or Amazon.com. So Wally finds himself in this world, and I didn't watch much more of the movie at that point. I found this so incredibly entertaining. Oh my God, what a view of the future! This is incredible. What a, in the animation and everything, I was really, really taken by it, but I decided to get in my quick ride. Alyssa, let me go for a quick ride. I went for my ride, and then I went to work. So at work, I got there, got settled, turned to my partner, and told him a little story about Wally. I said, you ever see this movie, Wally? He said, no, I never did. I said, well, I told him the story. You know, this robot lands on this burnt out Earth. He's a trash compactor. He's making buildings made out of garbage. There's only one a cockroach in the whole place, and a tiny little shriveled plant, and a big spaceship comes down, and this beautiful robot comes out and takes the plant. Wally falls in love with the robot, holds on to the spaceship as it goes up to some place where millions of humans live. It's a big contraption in the middle of the universe, and they're all on these vehicles, and they're all morbidly obese, looking at screens, drinking soft drinks. I said, what an incredible view of the future. And he said to me, Paul, that's not the future, that's the present. Wow. Chris, you're right. That is the present, isn't it? Interesting. People isolated, one to a vehicle, rushing around on highways, screens, distracted by screens, drinking soft drinks as they get ever more obese. And if you come to my ER, perhaps any ER, you'll see that most people in the ER are obese, and there are many that are morbidly obese, and many of them smoke, and many of them drink soft drinks and eat fast food and are extremely stressed out and resort to all sorts of entertainment and distraction in order to cope with the stress as their bodies become weaker and weaker and they become ill. And as a result of becoming ill, they need to see the doctor, and they come to the ER, and there they are. What a world we live in. So the question, the koan, is what would you do if you found yourself in this circumstance? Remember now, this is not totally the future. If you found yourself lying on one of these vehicles with the soft drink in your hand and a screen in front of your face, at this very moment, what would you do in this calamity? There you are. What would the response be? Now, Zen doesn't stand apart and judge this situation. It doesn't go, oh, woe is me, I'm caught here, I don't know what to do, I'm stuck, it's all pointless, going in circles, advertisements for B&L, by and large, and drinking soft drinks. What would you do? What is the response? How do you deal with this? Really, this is asking, how do you deal with your life? I was watching this movie thinking it was some future calamity, but there's a present calamity. Here we are. Vehicles, soft drinks. All of us inevitably are going to get old, get sick, eventually die. But while we're alive, there are wars, there are conflicts. Outside us, inside us. Struggles, difficulties. Disappointments, happiness that's transient, things to aim for, things to learn, things to do. But here we are. Whatever idea I may have of perfection, this calamity never comes close to matching it, ever. What is the response? Now we come to a zendo, and we hope that this is going to get us off of that conveyor belt. This is going to toss away the soft drink. This is going to get rid of all screens. This is going to make it all perfect. This is going to make me better. This is going to heal me. This is going to make me into a perfected bodhisattva. If I just do X, Y, and Z, if I just concentrate as hard as I can, if I do everything right, if I bow in the right direction, if I mindfully step foot, step after footstep, if I answer this koan, that koan, whatever it might be, then I'll get off this calamity. I'll make myself better, make myself perfect. And what happens? What happens is you become divided in two. You have this life, and you have the watcher looking to see if it's getting more perfect, trying to change it, grappling with it, lamenting over it, pushing that away. This is the human condition. This is lying on that vehicle. What do we do about that? What do we do? I'm going to share a koan. I actually thought it was in the Mumon Koan, but it isn't. It's a very famous Zen koan. Maybe it points a little bit at this situation of finding oneself in a calamity. And how do I respond? What is the healing thing? So this person was hiking in the woods. And I suppose this was in India somewhere, because there were tigers. And he heard a rustle behind him and looked, and oh my God, there's a tiger! And he went running down this trail, running, 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 trying to get away from this tiger. The tiger's nipping at its heels. If it catches him, he's going to get eaten. And he comes to a cliff and looks down, and below there are other tigers. And the tiger behind him is closing in, and what is he going to do? So he has to jump, and he just jumps off the cliff. And as he starts to slide down this very steep slope, he grabs onto a root. And holding onto this root, he sees the tiger up above drooling on him, and these two tigers below circling, waiting. And as the koan goes, he looked to his left, and there was a little strawberry bush. He picked the strawberry and put it in his mouth, and the final line in the koan is how sweet it tasted. Now I'm thinking this movie, Wall-E, and hearing the sound of that a straw makes when the glass is almost empty and you're sucking down that delicious fluid that you know is bad for you. Things are the way they are for mysterious reasons. Now, when I say mysterious, I don't mean magical. I mean that you'll never know exactly why it ended up just like this right now. You can see some reasons, some connections, but then you just have to ask, well, why did that happen? And why did that happen? And then you're into the turtles all the way down conundrum. In fact, the way things are right now, the way they are in this planet in Wall-E, the way they are my sneaking out trying to get past this family room and getting called in before I could do what I wanted to do, a blessing in disguise. This person holding onto the root, gradually pulling out from the wall. No one can say how it ended up that way. Why it ended up that way and not some other way. But that's the way it is right now. As physicists might put it, there's a new branch of physics. It's philosophical at this point, but I think it's growing in interest among some theoretical physicists, called biocentrism. This cloud of probability, the moment one becomes aware of your situation, collapses down to this one thing, as it is. Here it is. It's done. In a sense, it's absolute. Your situation right now is absolute. The thoughts in my mind are absolute. The smell of this incense is absolute. The pain in my right knee is absolute. It's happened. That's how I know it. It's happened. Now, ordinarily, the human condition is to separate from that and do battle with it, to divide oneself out, to say some other configuration is better, is preferable. Sure, other configurations are preferable. But what? But those configurations are not here right now. What do I do about that right now? Right now. What is my attitude of mind? That's the critical thing. It's not so much what decision do I make and what action do I take. And all of those things are certainly determined by the way things are now, by my training, by my desires, by what I'm capable of, by what's available to me. I may have choices available to me that someone in Guatemala doesn't have available to them. That's part of this karmic thing. But what's the attitude of mind? Are we able to put it down? Put down the effort, the struggle to change what has happened? Constantly trying to make it different, better, other than what it is. Missing something critical in that. Being divided in two. An entity looking out at my life. My life not matching some template. And the entity feeling trapped in that, struggling with that, separated from it. Then I hear about this practice called Zen. And of course, I initially think it's something that's going to fix it, change it, make it better, make me perfect, get rid of all my painful feelings, get rid of all the conflicts in my life. So I bring to it the same thinking. The same approach, holding up a template, comparing what is to the perfect template in my mind, and then doing battle to try to make this form into some other form, and missing something critical in this, critical. I remember this person who jumped off the cliff. Is holding on to this root that's pulling out from the wall. In this extremity, it's done. He can't go back to the top of the cliff. He's holding on to this root. There's nothing that can be done about that right now. And yet, there's a strawberry. How sweet it tasted. How sweet. Imagine this person. Maybe he only has a moment to live. With this strawberry in his mouth. How sweet it tasted. The strawberry, the root pulling out from the wall, the tiger on the top of the cliff, the tiger's on the bottom of the cliff. This situation that I find myself in, called my life, how sweet it tasted. All the time I was doing battle with it, thinking it was wrong, standing apart, being the judge and jury over myself. And I found this practice, and it told me, plunge into the present moment as it comes. Enter it with your whole mind and body. Don't hold anything back. How sweet it tasted. Pain in my knee. Situation at home. Habit patterns that I struggle with. Ways in which I've failed. Ways in which I've succeeded. In this posture, with this attitude of mind, attentive, dispassionate, because I realize that the way it is right now is the collapsing of the cloud of probability into this one thing. How sweet it tasted. Now, about this sweet taste. This is really the critical thing, the sweet taste. Remember now, it's not just the strawberry. It's the person that's between a rock and a hard place. The roots pulling out. Strawberries aren't that sweet when you're not in that situation. So I'm going to read to you something about a sweet taste, and I've read this before, and this is the third ox herding picture. So these ox herding pictures are really wonderful depictions of various stages in Zen practice. I might read the first one too, seeking the ox, so we'll read up to the third one. So seeking the ox, it shows that it's a picture of a man in a woods looking around anxiously, lost. And the poem here goes, desolate through forests and fearful in jungles. He is seeking an ox which he does not find. Okay, think about this now. Seeking an ox that he does not find. Perhaps some notion of perfection. Some notion of how it ought to be. But it isn't like that. And I can't find it. And I can't change it into that. I've tried. I've done everything. I've gone to Sesshins. I've made lots of money. I became a whatever. It didn't fix it. Up and down dark, nameless, wide-flowing rivers, in deep mountain thickets, he treads many bypaths. Ah, the human condition. Bone tired, heart weary, he carries on his search for this something which he yet cannot find. At evening he hears cicadas chirping in the trees. It's always a little connection to the truth. This bone weary person hears a car driving down the road. So then the next picture is finding the tracks. So I'll just read the poem here. Innumerable footprints has he seen, in the forest and along the water's edge. Over yonder does he see the trampled grass. Even in the deepest gorges of the topmost mountains, can't hide this ox's nose which reacheth right to heaven. What is this ox? What is it? What is the sweetness of that strawberry? What is that slurping of the last drop of that soft drink lying on this vehicle watching your screen? What is that? What is that awareness? What is that experience? What is that attitude of mind? How is it opening its arms wide? How is it embracing? How is it letting go of the last shred of fighting resistance? Entering with whole mind and body. Entering your actual experience. No longer standing apart from it. Not naming it. Not judging it. Not comparing it. What is that? Then we get to the third oxherding picture. So this is called First Glimpse of the Ox. Now the ox is a classic, picturesque description in Zen of something massive, something extremely powerful, something much, much bigger than the small self that identifies with a life and a name and a set of characteristics. Yet strangely, this ox is hidden. As large as it is, as powerful as it is, it's very hard to see this ox. Because this ox, in the iconography of Zen, is pure white. It's hidden, it doesn't stand out. So I'm going to read you this description of this first glimpse of the ox. If she will but listen intently to everyday sounds, she will come to realization, and at that instant see the very source, the capital S. These six senses are no different from this true source. In every activity, the source is manifestly present, not hidden, shining from everything, shining. It is analogous to the salt and water of the binder and paint. I like this line. It's analogous to the salt and water. If you go anywhere on earth and you taste the ocean, anywhere you go, it's salty. When the inner vision is properly focused, one comes to realize that that which is seen is identical with the true source. Ah! Some perfect thing is identical with the true source? Something that matched my template of how it ought to be? Doesn't say that here. It says, that which is seen, that which appears, that which you think, that which you feel, that emotion arising, that smell, that sound, that feeling, is identical with the true source. Identical. All this time I'm doing battle with these things. They're not perfect. They have to be some other way. When I get all my ducks lined up in a row, then I'll get enlightenment. Doesn't say that here. It says when the inner vision is properly focused, one comes to realize that that which is seen is identical with the true source. And then there's a poem. This is pointing at it. Pointing. A nightingale warbles on a twig. The sun shines on undulating willows. There stands the ox. Where could it hide? That splendid head, those stately horns. What artist could portray them? Now, who's the artist? Who's the artist trying to paint the picture of this notion of perfection? Shouldn't have been the way that my life is right now, right? I painted a different picture for myself, trying to get there. But this says, what artist could portray them? No artist can portray the truth. Unnecessary. It shines from everything. It emanates from everything. Every situation, every emotion, every feeling, every problem is emanating this, shining this. What is it? To find it, you have to watch very closely the actuality of what is arising. Remember this man holding on to the root, putting the strawberry, the attitude of mind of this biting into the strawberry with the root pulling out from the wall and the tartars below. That intensity, that acuteness, that plunging into the actuality of your circumstance exactly as it arises. Is it? It shines from that approach, not from comparison. I'm going to read one more thing to you about this. This is also something that I've shared before, but I think in this context it would be helpful. So how does Wang Po put this thing that's shining from ordinary things? A nightingale warbling on a twig. A piece of trash lying on the street. How does Wang Po put it? So, this is really a beautiful thing from the writings. It's called the Zen Teachings of Wang Po. Now, Wang Po was the teacher of Rinzai. So he was a Tang Dynasty Zen master of the highest caliber. And this is one of his writings. So he says, our original Buddha nature is, in highest truth, devoid of any atom of objectivity. This is so important. Devoid of any atom of objectivity. It is absolutely intimate. What is most intimate? It is void, omnipresent, silent, and pure. It is glorious and mysterious, peaceful joy, and that is all. So this void, omnipresent, silent, pure. If it's void, omnipresent, silent, and pure, it can dissolve in anything. It's like the binder in paint. It's like the salt in water. It doesn't stand apart. It isn't something preferable to your life as it presents. It's embedded in it. This is why it's so important to attend to each moment by moment arising of all the dharmas with small d. Enter deeply into it by awakening to it yourself. That which is before you is it in all its fullness, utterly complete. We could just stop right there. That which is before you is it in all its fullness, utterly complete. There is naught besides. Even if you go through all the stages of a bodhisattva's progress towards Buddhahood, one by one, when at last in a single flash you attain to full realization, you will only be realizing the Buddha nature which has been with you all the time. And by all the foregoing stages you will have added to it nothing at all. So why are we trying to fix our lives, make them match some idea of perfection? If I become the perfect Zen student, I sit Zazen in the perfect way, I bring my mind to the perfect equipoise, you will add to that nothing at all. You will come to look upon those eons of work and achievement as no better than unreal actions performed in a dream. That is why the Tathagata, and that's one of the appellations of the Buddha, the Tathagata means one who has gone thus, said, I truly attained nothing from complete unexcelled enlightenment. Had there been anything attained, Dipankara Buddha would not have made the prophecy concerning me. And Dipankara Buddha was one of the primordial Buddhas who, in a past life of Shakyamuni Buddha, made the prophecy that Shakyamuni Buddha would become a Buddha. So the Buddha said, had I not gained nothing from complete enlightenment, this prophecy would not have been made. So the rice has been cooked for a long time. Let's eat this rice. We'll end there today.